Hello and welcome back to the show. I'm Tom. That has not changed. Today we have an interview with Ryan Nosek, one of four founders at Ghost Town Brewing in Oakland. I think last week I promised a big episode this week, and that interview I was referring to is actually going to be next week. But I am stoked to have Ghost Town for this episode. I'm a big fan of Ghost Town, mostly because of their West Coast IPAs, which, as you know, is something I enjoy. Which we do talk about in this episode, but they also do a variety of lagers, a few dark beers. They have some fooders for both on the clean and the sour side. They have a sour barrel room. I think Ryan said there's a couple hundred barrels. It's pretty impressive to see how much they have, how big their space is, how much they're doing. And I think I have some pictures, so check that out on the Instagram account. You probably know by now I'm not big on the hoppy lagers, but I did have a Mosaic Pilsner called, I think, Cave Dweller from Ghost Town. It's pretty tasty. Anyway, Ryan talks about Ghost Town's story, the group, how they got started, the metal vibe that they have there, which if you go to the tap room, you pick up on pretty quick, and our mutual love of West Coast IPA. A lot to love about Ghost Town, so let's get to the conversation. Why don't we start with your story and what led you to here and to opening Ghost Town, how it all kind of came to be.
Sure. So I guess it could start off as, you know, just growing up in down south in like Ventura County, you know, was really into like punk and metal music, and we used to come up to Oakland pretty frequently because there was a really good scene up here, a lot of metal, a lot of punk. And then in the early 2000s, 2002 or 2001, I moved up here full time to Oakland. And I've lived in West Oakland, where the brewery is now, for about 20 years. Through that, you know, I played music, guitar mostly. Started a band around, I don't know, 2006 or so, with a couple dudes. And we used to play, you know, just down the street here from the brewery, at a rehearsal studio called Soundwave. And, you know, it's really expensive to practice there, and we didn't have a ton of money, so we were homebrewing in my garage, and I live in an area of Oakland which is called Ghost Town, right over in the little triangle area. And you know, we were homebrewing in the garage, playing music, and we just, you know, thought, well, what if we, you know, brewed some beer, and somehow it was able to pay for, you know, a rehearsal studio. So we got like a little space in 2011, down the street on Union here. And first thing we did was we built a rehearsal studio so we could play music, and then kind of just got a little nano system, like one barrel. Mm-hmm. And we're, you know, brewing beer on the weekends, mostly just playing music. And then, yeah, over some time, just brewed more and more and more, you know, brewing multiple times a day, brewing every day, getting, you know, bigger tanks from really small system to, you know, 7-barrel tanks to 15s. And then we opened up this space here in like 2018 with our 15-barrel brew house, you know, bigger fermenters, 30-barrel fermenters. And the big part of it, obviously, was opening a tap room. We were just like a distro only small nano brewery, so just filling kegs and selling them around town. So yeah, and then a few years doing it at this level, just, you know, keep getting some more tanks. We opened up our second tap room in March of this year, in East Oakland. And, yeah, it's just been crazy busy. We don't, unfortunately play a lot of music anymore. We mostly just brew beer. So yeah, that's kind of the quick origin, of Ghost Town, and kind of where the name came from, because it's where I live and that's where we first started.
Okay. And so, talking about music, how much does the musical your background in music and playing or wanting to play not as much as you want anymore, how much does that influence the beer that you're making or the styles? I feel like there's always like an artistic connection, whether it's music or some other form of art.
Yeah, I mean, it's the, you know, theme of our brewery is you know, metal. We're all like really into metal, you know, death metal, black metal, you name it. A lot of punk too, and that's kind of our roots. So we kind of ran with it. A lot of people think it comes off as like Halloween-y, which I guess is okay, because we're really spooky. But you know, it's more like a metal music kind of theme. So all of our artwork, our branding, kind of focuses off of that theme. And yeah, I mean, we feel like it, you know, obviously resonates really well for a group of people, but even people who, you know, aren't into metal can, you know, think it's kind of dark or interesting. And it doesn't have to be just for one type of group, but, you know, we think it's a little bit broader, while still kind of being true to ourselves of who we are.
Yeah. I was going to say that there's definitely, like a theme. I would have said kind of, or like a vibe, like kind of metal.
Yeah.
So I figured that was related, but I didn't know it was that related.
Oh,
to,
yeah,
to music that you listened to and played and yep, you had that much background in music.
Yeah.
So you said this location opened 2018, mm-hmm, and then you just opened another one, yep, in Laurel. Are you brewing there at all or just here?
No, that's just the Laurel spot is just a tap room, like a satellite tap room, and full kitchen, which is kind of new for us because we don't have food here. So it's just another, you know, another way for folks to hang out, get some ghost town on tap directly from us, kind of using our, you know, like our environment, our vibe, you know, the freshest way to possibly get it. We decided on putting, you know, another tap room in Oakland as opposed to like, you know, dropping them sporadically throughout the Bay Area. Just because like, you know, Oakland's kind of, it's a big city for one, but you know, it's not, a lot of people don't like to travel too far, to go to, you know, specific places. So we thought it'd be nice to just drop a tap room, somewhere that we figure was a little underserved, for those areas, you know, especially for craft beer. And so far it's been excellent. It's been, way better than our expectation ever was. So.
Okay. So yeah, I was going to ask about the tap room. Is that like, you see the different models, like, Modern Times went, you know, San Diego to Portland, Oregon. They've got one here in Oakland.
Yeah.
But then locally Fieldwork has, I don't know if it's five or six different places, but those are all a little bit closer. Mm-hmm. In from Ventura, actually, Topatopa's, they've got like four places that are all fairly close.
Yeah.
So I was going to ask if that is kind of, if that's a model you're going for, like more of the local, saturate that and not reach out somewhere that people maybe don't know ghost town as well, or if it was just get another location and have a kitchen and it's being your own location, obviously margins are a lot better.
I think when we started to think about opening up an additional tap room or you know, we looked at what other breweries were doing, and obviously like Fieldwork, because they're local here, was, you know, kind of like, it felt kind of like the model, I guess. And a few other breweries have kind of, it seemed like, followed that model a little bit by putting tap rooms a little further away. And I was probably on board with that. But we were, I think it was like a few years ago before CBC, we visited a friend in Santa Fe who has a brewery out there. We were doing a collab with them. And, you know, Santa Fe is a pretty small town. It's not like huge or anything. And there were like breweries that had multiple locations, like four in Santa Fe. And I thought it was crazy. I was like, how is that sustainable? Like, cause this is not that populous of an area. I mean, it's, mm-hmm, a lot of tourists and stuff or whatever. But, after I saw that, I was kind of blown away and I was like, you know what? Maybe we don't have to like put a tap room 50 miles away or, you know, I still think that works. And particularly if you were using it, you know, from a self-distribution perspective, and using it as like a hub, so that you could, you know, extend your reach or something like that. That would be a pretty good way to do it. But for us, it was just like, you know, Oakland's a big town. I think I'd like to just pop another one here and see how it goes. And like I said, it's been awesome. It's different enough from this space and far enough away where I don't think it, you know, cannibalizes too much. We do, you know, a lot of people who come here would say like, oh, it's right by my house. And again, we think that spot's like, you know, it's been coming up for a while, but it's also great to just have, again, craft beer in a place that was kind of underserved. Like, we could have went to a more saturated area, even in Oakland, like Temescal or, I don't know, College or Rock Ridge or Berkeley or whatever. But and that's not to say we wouldn't do that, but, you know, I thought it was better for us, one, because it's our second tap room that we're doing, but also, you know, be able to keep it a little closer, monitor it a little easier, because we don't have a huge staff of people that just open facilities or, you know, do stuff like that. It's just us.
Right.
So it made it a lot easier, the whole process, and again, we were just blown away by how well it was received over there. So,
right on. So the going back, I guess, to the kind of the origin of Ghost Town, it's not just you here. You have, is it two partners?
There's actually three of us, or four of us, including me. So it's the band.
Okay.
It has the guitarist, bassist, another guitarist, and a drummer, basically. Those are the four, you know, founders or whatever of the brewery. And yeah, we still all work here.
Okay. I just had a vision of like a Always Sunny episode. The band opens a brewery.
Yeah.
Well, we can talk about writing that episode. And so you guys are all still involved, like different parts of the brewery, different.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who's doing the brewing? Is that one of you guys?
So it was for quite a long time. One of my partners, Adam, was basically the main kind of brewer for a long time on our small system. We realized after a while that, you know, we weren't as good as we hoped we were, right? I mean, I think a lot of people, I think it's hard for them maybe to admit that. But for us, I don't think it was that hard. So, I mean, we liked what we made, but, you know, we thought it was really important to really, especially once we got our new system and we were going to be producing a lot more beer, that we really get a staff in here that was a little, you know, more professional than we were, that knew what they were doing, that could really get us to that next level. And that's when we got Justin Burt, who was formerly of Black Diamond. He came by to be our head brewer, and he's been here doing that since. And then we've, you know, got a few other great brewers on staff. So Adam now, who used to do the brewing, more focuses on packaging. So he's like our packaging lead. So who does, you know, all the canning, all the kegging, and runs that team with them. Another founder, Jason, is kind of like, he has a sales background. So he runs our sales team, which is about four people, including him, that cover, you know, I don't know, 60-mile radius or whatever from the brewery. And then Sam, who's one of our other co-founders, he's the operations, like production management kind of side of it. So he makes sure all the stuff gets through and the schedules and some of the more operations-oriented stuff.
Okay.
And then I mostly focus on the design. So I do all the graphic design for the labels, do the brand management kind of stuff. And then I operate mostly the facilities. So, like, let's get a new tap room. Like, what does that mean? Okay, like, I build it, you know, kind of set it all up, and then, you know, hire staff to run it and stuff like that. So
okay,
a little more, I don't know, operations, HR person? I don't know what you could call it. Yeah, whatever they need me to do is kind of what I do.
Okay. It's funny you said your new brewer, or now brewer, was at Black Diamond. I was just thinking about Black Diamond on my way over here. That it's, I don't know how long they've been out of business, but I remember, that's weird. Just a weird connection.
Yeah, we met those dudes at like a, I don't know, like it was like a White Labs, like a yeast class or something like that. We met Paul and Justin. Paul was the head brewer at Black Diamond, and Justin was his assistant. And yeah, just formed a great relationship with those guys. And eventually, both Paul and Justin came through Ghost Town at some point before Black Diamond closed up. So,
okay.
Well, yeah, I mean, they made great brews, White Witch and Rampage and a lot of favorites, especially amongst folks up in Concord, up that area. Mm-hmm. And Justin kind of brought a lot of them over to Ghost Town as fans because they just liked his beer so much. So it's great to have those folks kind of follow him around.
Yeah, I always remembered the... When I think of Black Diamond, I always think of Rampage in 22-ounce bottles, which are also not really much of a thing anymore. But
yeah, I mean, the beer industry kind of switched a little bit, from that core lineup of beers that people make to this, like, heavily rotated...
Yeah, what's new, what's new.
Exactly. So if you weren't really able to kind of get in with that, mindset... Or flip a switch and just start making a bunch of different stuff, it was probably tougher, than certain other spots that could do it. So
yeah. Yeah. You guys do a lot of different stuff. I feel like I see a new release or maybe another release that you haven't done in a while.
Yeah.
On a 15 barrel system, how do you keep cranking them out like that and keeping the beer fresh and so many different beers, different recipes or, tweaks to recipes, different mm-hmm. styles, IPAs, lagers. We walked past through all the sour stuff.
Yeah, it's pretty tricky to do it that way. our sales guys, are the ones mostly who ask for all these kind of new beers, but we also like making them a lot. We did something crazy like 125 SKUs last year or something like that. The size of our system, I think, actually kind of helps with that a little bit because it's still pretty small. Like 15 barrels isn't like a massive system. And then having the tank space, which I think there's like 14 or like 15 fermenters over there. Some of them are small, some of them are big, from 15 up to 60s and stuff like that. So we're able to... we're brewing twice a day, every day on that system, filling up the tanks. And they wow. just, it's about scheduling. But yeah, we'll have like yesterday we released three beers. Last Friday we released three beers. And every once in a while you'll hit like a weird lull where it's one or two. And then sometimes it's like four or five, depending upon the styles and how long they take to make. And then about a year ago, or I guess a year and a half ago, we brought over Steve, who is running our barrel program now, our sour program. He was at a few breweries in the Bay, most recently at Almanac. And he basically started this program from scratch. It was just a whole nother area of beer we wanted to get into. We all really like mixed culture beers, wild ales, sours. And, we thought it would really round out our offerings to have some of those because a lot of people ask for them.
Yeah.
We obviously have a bunch of IPAs. We'd love to have, a lot of lagers, pilsners, pales, and stuff in the dark, malt spectrum as well. But we feel like the sours really round out the offerings too, so that no matter really what your flavor is, we'll have something available. So that's kind of also one of the good parts about having so many releases or making so many different beers is that we have a really nice round offering of beers.
Yeah, no matter what people prefer, you've generally got
something
that they're going to
want
to drink. Back to the brew house itself. She said it's a 15 barrel system, and then varying fermenters. How much are you guys putting out like in a normal year? I guess we've had maybe one normal year before.
Well, I mean, we were, every year it increases a little bit. I think last year it was something like maybe 7,000 barrels or something like that. And we actually just purchased a brand new brew house, which is a 30-barrel four-vessel system, which will be replacing our 15-barrel system. So we should be able to probably get, somewhere in the range of like 10 to 12,000 barrels after we get that kind of expansion done.
Okay.
Which has been in the works for quite a while because we've been kind of maxing out our turns on that 15. We had to make a choice as to whether we wanted to hire a bunch of staff and run it 24 hours a day or, and potentially have people burn out or or just, you know, spend the capital and then, you know, get a new brew house and make it much easier.
Yeah, be a little more
time efficient,
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, right now we can probably get, like, I mean, if we really wanted to, maybe 45 barrels brewed in a day on the new system. In about the same time, or actually probably less, we could do 120 on the new system. So, and we don't even need to do that. You know, we can just kind of, instead of brewing twice a day every day, we could, you know, keep where we're at and brew three times a week or whatever, and have a little extra time to, you know, pay attention to the cellar and you know, clean stuff up and work on new beers and recipes and things that we want to, you know, focus on as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I had no idea you were brewing that much. I mean, 7,000 barrels is, like you said, that's not for a brewery, not a ton of beer, but for a craft brewery, that's a lot of beer.
Yeah. I mean,
especially these days when I think the average for a craft brewery is like 800 barrels a year.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know what the average is. I mean, we, you know, we have breweries here that are much bigger than we are, like Fieldwork. Mm-hmm. And
yeah,
I mean, I don't know what Faction brews, but Roger makes a ton of beer too, really great beer. And, I mean, yeah, even like Original Pattern and stuff like that, they brew a lot too. So, but with the pandemic, you know, we did switch everything to cans for, I mean, almost all. And, you know, we were still trying to, you know, survive it by doing that. And we ended up getting a lot of retail accounts. So we're doing a lot more packaging in cans than we were before. And we kind of just kept those customers, even with stuff kind of reopening and kegs starting to flow back out to the bars and restaurants. So, yeah, I mean, it's just a bunch of brewing just happening all the time.
Yeah. How much, I mean, obviously switching essentially all to, non-draft during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. How much of that has come back so far for the keg and restaurant bar side of things?
Like how much, like percentage wise or something?
Yeah, I mean, just roughly.
I mean, like, so we used to do, it's probably like something like 60-40, 60% kegs and then like 40%, you know, packet, you know, okay, cans or whatever. Then it went to like something like 95%. We were just, you know, kegging off stuff just for the tap room to go. And then now it's probably back almost normal. So, you know, maybe even a little more. So yeah, maybe back to like, I don't know, 50%, something like that.
As people can go places and sit down and have a beer, come in, have a beer, yeah, instead of just 4-pack to go or,
yeah,
even a growler to go.
I mean, even though the pandemic is still kind of active, you know, a lot of places have been able to open with, you know, social distancing, parklets, you know, different things like that. So it's been last few months they've been coming back, even though it's not officially over for another, well, what officially over, but you know, when the state's supposed to reopen at 100%, we'll see what that actually looks like. Cause, I assume a lot of places will just start to open. And then, you know, unfortunately, there was a lot of businesses that did close that'll just never come back
too. Yeah, so I've seen a few places that have just closed, just restaurants that have closed, you know, in the last month or so.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how did they survive that long and then just close now? I don't know if it's like hiring staff and then having more to pay and not enough money coming in. I don't know, but...
Yeah, I mean, you know, a lot of stuff might have been really tight even before the pandemic happened. And, you know, the government assistance with PPP and some of that stuff.
Yeah, a lot of that probably helped. Run out.
And that, yeah, it's been running out. I mean, I'm sure for a lot of people, it already ran out a long time ago. And, you know, the second round and the restaurant revitalization stuff still kind of coming for folks to use. But, you know, a lot of people, I think, just had to take a hard look at what was going on and make a bad, you know, a hard call for them, yeah, for themselves and their staff. And they lost a lot of businesses in the Bay. So it's super bummer, but you know, we understand.
Yeah. Well, for the beer, what are your styles? I mean, do the styles that you guys do reflect kind of the whole band's preferences?
I mean, I think our preferences kind of have changed over the years, a little bit. I mean, just our personal preferences. We love West Coast IPA. Like all day, every day, we could probably just enjoy those. But we've really, really started to enjoy, you know, lagers, pilsners, West Coast pilsners, cold IPA, or whatever you want to call it. Those have been like some of our favorite beers. And we recently got, I guess 6 months ago or so, we got these Oak Fooders, which were, we had been using some for the sour program, but we got four of them just for clean beer. So, and we just pump lagers through them just to get kind of the wood character. So those have been really cool to see how they turn out. We've been doing, like, we did Baltic Porter. We have a Schwarz beer that we released yesterday. You know, our standard Pilsner, which is called Geisterfaust. We do a wood version called Geisterholz. And yeah, it's been super cool just to see how those beers age and how they, you know, how they change over time. You can get that vanilla from the wood, maybe a little tannin. So it's been, those are kind of like some of our favorite beers that we've been making now, but we'll still always love West Coast IPA.
Okay.
We love hops.
Yeah. Thank you for that.
Love hops. I mean, in Hazy's, like, I wouldn't say that we were like super stoked when they first started kind of coming out. But it's a style that, you know, I think can be done, that can be done really well. And there's like some breweries that just make awesome Hazy's. We have a little bit of a hard time making an IPA that's not bitter, just because we love it so much. But we, you know, we've tried to tone it down, and we make Hazy's. And I think, you know, we've grown to like the style a lot more than we initially did. Ours are probably still just a hair too bitter, for like the you know, hazy seeking palate.
Yeah,
but we feel like it's a way to get you to drink more West Coast.
Which is convert people back to West Coast.
Come on back to the West Coast. Yeah. No, we like them both, but yeah, I mean, those are our, that's kind of, I think, what we're digging collectively as a brewery. It just depends, you know, again, time of year too, and you know, what we're, how we're feeling about stuff. But yeah, the West Coast Pilsners and those West Coast IPAs are just awesome.
Yeah. You're talking about the using fooders for clean beers. How long are you, like, how much time do they need in there before they, you know, kind of soften up a little bit or get some of that oaky, some of that wood character?
So each style that we put in has been like a little different, as far as time wise goes. Like certain things, like our rice lager that we put through, seem to like really get the character much faster. Maybe because it wasn't as complex. But like English mild we put through, or you know, the Baltic Porter, have a little bit more complex malts in them, so it maybe takes a little while longer. What's also interesting is, like, you know, when the fooders are new, it takes less time, and then each preceding time we fill them, it might take a little longer and a little longer. Eventually they'll go neutral and they'll impart no flavor, at which point our program manager for the sour, Steve, will kind of inherit them and fill them with bugs and do whatever he wants to do.
Yeah, because then you don't have to worry about the contamination or crossover, because that's what you want. So yeah,
I mean, so the answer, it's a little tricky. Every time we fill it, it's a little less, it's a little more used, right? So it takes a little longer each time, but we literally just have to sit there and taste them, watch how they change over time, you know, fight the urge maybe to just release it and see how it, if it stops getting more wood or if it's going to change or get more vanilla. It also depends on what we kind of wanted from the style. So anyway, it's been a lot of fun just kind of tasting them and seeing where they evolve.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to keep going, you just got to keep tasting them. There's worse ways to deal with it, right?
There is worse ways to deal with it. Yeah, I mean, the sour program is very similar in that regard too, where, you know, Steve's got 200 barrels or whatever that taste kind of all the time to see, like, where are they at? Like, how have they changed? Is he happy with where they're at? And some of them, like I said, kind of on the way in, you know, some of them are 18 months old, some are a year old, some are 6 months, some are a month. And, you know, he could kind of blend them together to get just that thing he wants.
Yeah. Do you see differences, even, you know, not in a giant rickhouse in Kentucky, but do you see differences even like ground level barrels to something up, whatever, like four barrels high or whatever they are?
I mean, that'd probably be a better question for Steve. I don't know. These are all used, you know, wine barrels. We do have some clean barrels, like clean, like bourbon barrels and stuff for some of our barley wines and imperial stouts. I don't know how much they vary between, you know, each rack or whatever. But I imagine that there's some, I mean, just from temperature, exposure from light, you know, just different things like that could probably make them change a little bit.
Yeah. It's when you said, when you're talking about the fooders and, you know, each pass through them, you're going to pick up a little bit less. That just made me think of, you know, bourbon barrels are one-time use.
Yep.
And that's, you know, illegal for the definition. That's, you can't use it twice for bourbon. So, you know, they'll go to Scotland or breweries or wherever. That's, which, you know, a lot of breweries have been able to benefit from that by
getting
barrels, and
they are ready to go when they arrive here. I mean, those bourbon barrels, I still have a lot of char on them, and they smell so good. So we're always happy to fill them up with a bunch of beer and see how they age over time. I think we've done like two barrel aged, maybe three barrel aged releases over the last few years. Our last one was like a 2 year. Imperial Stout, I think it was. Or actually, it might have been the rye wine. I can't remember. But anyway, really cool to see how those turn out. All those like really big notes of marshmallow and caramel, and like just, they're so delicious. Very high alcohol, but delicious.
Yeah, there's, I feel like at a certain point, sometimes breweries just push it like, how high can we make this go? And it's like, all right, how realistic is a 17% beer?
You'd be surprised, man. There are people who love that stuff.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I can't drink like a bunch of it. And we usually serve that stuff in like 10-ounce pours here, just because like I wouldn't.
Yeah, you can at least at the tap room, you can control what size you're pouring.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are people who just really enjoy super high ABV beers. And that's why I think people make them. I mean, just, you know, it's a style.
120 minutes, still a thing.
Yeah. I mean, they're big, they're sweet. They're, I mean, yeah, even doubles and stuff like that. People totally dig them. So, we keep making them.
Yeah. I mean, as long as people buy them.
Yeah.
Why not make them?
Of course.
Yeah.
They're never going to be like, you know, they'll never be like an IPA or whatever, but, they're fun to make. They're great to taste, particularly over time. And they're fun to release. I mean, people get super excited about them, and you know, packaging them and stuff like that. So they should exist, and I like them a lot. I don't drink a lot of them though, just to be honest.
Yeah, I
can't
like them
that much.
I like them as with the ability to taste them over time, and like I'll get a, you know, even a six pack of like Bigfoot.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, every few months or so, try to hold off from drinking them too fast. But
yeah,
taste them over time. That's where I really enjoy those styles.
Yeah, I've been trying for like a long time to get like those 8-ounce like stubby cans, because I just think they'd be so cool to fill. Like not only like really big beers in those, but also like our cream ale, just like crushable little cans. Cause that's like how much like I'd want. Anyway, I just can't, I can't get, I can only get like, you know, 2 million of them at a time. So it's not really an option for me at the moment. Maybe one day I'll be able to scoop some up, in a reasonable amount. But
I told you earlier, I was surprised by how much space you have here. I didn't realize how much, and that there was two different warehouses, but I don't know if you have room for a 2 million can stack.
No, not at all. we got a lot of space, which is getting used up pretty quickly. We can't hold just endless pallets of cans, because obviously we do a lot of 16-ounce stuff too, so those have to take priority, and I can't hold, you know, 50 pallets of little cans just for my indulgence of high ABV beers.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been interesting starting to see those little 8-ounce cans just, you know, on social media and just that it's more than just, or it can be more than just samples for accounts, that but it can actually be its own, you know, package for the consumer.
Yeah, I mean, I totally think it could be. The whole beverage packing industry and like canning lines and stuff like that aren't really geared for those probably too much. But you could, you know, our sales team does use the 8 ounce stubbies for that exact purpose. When they, you know, if they need samples or whatever, but yeah, I think it would be so cool to just grab like a, you know, yeah, 6 pack or maybe who knows 8 pack if it was like a cream ale of 8 ounce cans, and then you just take them to the river and let loose.
Well, you guys do so many, like you said, IPAs, some hazy stuff, pale ales, hoppy pilsners. What hops do you prefer? I feel like every time I see a new release, it's a different combination, different variety, newer stuff. Mm-hmm. What is it that you personally and the rest of the team are, I guess, if you can answer for them, what hops is it that you're kind of moving towards or prefer?
I mean, I think like, you know, when Mosaic came out, like we were all like, whoa, this is so good. And we got, you know, we got pretty caught up in some of those newer hops too. But we were fortunate enough to be able to do some hop selection for the last few years. And so we select our own, like Citra, Mosaic, Centennial. So those are the hops that we obviously have the most of, because we, you know, have to buy a certain amount to be able to select them. We're super into the Southern Hemisphere stuff. We really like that. But you know, recently, I don't know if it's just happenstance, but like the Centennial we selected, we were just so blown away with. Like we did like a smash IPA with Centennial, which is like, nobody does that. It's weird.
Yeah, it was like 20 years ago, man.
But it was so good. We were like super stoked on it. Yeah, we've been using like El Dorado, you know, some of these like, I guess, less sexy hops, like, you know, Equinaut and stuff like that. And we've been mixing some of those in. And then like getting into like Columbus again, you know, and just, I don't know, just getting really, just kind of like moving back and forward in time for hops. I think the crop years kind of help determine that for us too, like what's really tasting good. Like, you know, like last year's Mosaic was great or whatever, but you know, it's been better in previous years. So, and like the Citra or whatever was super delicious this year as well. So we'll, you know, we see what's kind of coming out, and we'll, you know, just come up with some cool combinations that we like. And, our head brewer, Justin, just like, that's what he loves to do. Just like come up with different combos for hops, try them out. Our 15 barrel system kind of allows us to experiment and just, you know, not have to worry too much about it. You know, yeah, just keep iterating on it. But yeah, those hops are obviously like, we love, you know, Citra, Mosaic, Centennial, Cascade, whatever we can get. We love hops. Whatever hops we can get, we'll give them a try. But yeah, I mean, it changes every year.
Have you guys gone down to Southern Hemisphere, to New Zealand yet?
No, we haven't. We were supposed to at the pandemic year, so obviously that didn't happen, and then this year was not going to happen either, so who knows, maybe in the future we'll be able to go over there and select some Nelson or you know, Rewaka or something cool.
Yeah, I've heard, I think it's New Zealand Cascade now is like one of the new hot ones, and it's been interesting to see, like you said, Centennial and Cascade, and now this New Zealand Cascade, and these, I don't know, like so much fluctuation between styles, but also between hops and what's hot and what's not. And
yeah,
what's, like you said, Equinaut. I feel like there was a year for Equinaut, and then it's kind of, you know, it didn't take off maybe as obviously like Citra or Mosaic, but, or Strata this last couple of years.
Yeah. Strata's really been coming on. I mean, we love that hop too. Last year for harvest, we drove up to Coleman and scooped up like a bunch of wet hop Strata. We drove back down and got it in the kettle real fast. It was a long drive, but That wet hop beer turned out so awesome. I mean, it was just so, like, sappy and dank and just, it was awesome. So, yeah, Strata is something we've been really excited about in recent years, too. Just playing with it, seeing what it does, and been blown away by that one. And we like to get our hands on weird experimental hops, too, from different folks. Try it out, you know, see what we like about it. Sometimes they're weird. You know, sometimes they taste like wood. Sometimes they are, you know, more tropical. Like Sabro is very coconutty, which we can't really get into, as much.
Yeah, I have my opinions on Sabro. They're not favorable.
I think, like, just, like, a little bit of Sabro can just turn anything kind of tropical. But, like, I'm talking about a little bit.
Yeah.
Just, it helps, I think, make that something seem a little more tropical. But for those coconut dudes out there, like, they love that stuff. And, you know, I've had some really, really good Sabro beers. I do like it when it leans a little more lime for me than the coconut, but, you know, that's just my preference.
Yeah, I feel like it's got to be a very fine line where it just, for me, it just turns into sunscreen.
Yeah.
And, like, all right, if you're making a Mai Tai IPA or whatever, I can see where this is going, but coconut's not my jam in the first place, so yeah. I remember seeing when that hop started coming out more and more, and it's like, I don't like this.
I will say that it's really expressive hop. I mean, if you just think about, like, hops and, like, what you get from them, like, how much, you know, aroma or how much flavor, like, that hop does kick it out.
It definitely does what it says it does.
In a way that's pretty, like, intense, which is rad, you know. If we could get some other hops that were maybe not coconut that had that same expressive nature, it'd be pretty cool.
Yeah. I think I'm pretty well out of questions. Anything that you would want people to know about Ghost Town that maybe they don't, or what's the next step for Ghost Town? Or
yeah, I don't next steps are always funny because every time I think I know what I'm doing, like, I don't, like, it's just, it's so, it seems like it's always an arms race, or it's just like this and that, and it's just, I don't know, every week's different. it's been exciting, I think, I would say, particularly here in Oakland, to see, like, so many breweries pop up. Like, I don't know how it is, but, like, I think we're the oldest brewery in Oakland now, because, you know, there were a couple other ones that folded up or whatever, so, yeah, like, just watching, I think there's, like, something like 14 breweries or something in Oakland. It's been wild to see the craft beer scene kind of, like, just go crazy here, and see it kind of become, like, a beer destination, which is super awesome, because we love having other breweries around, and seeing, like, new breweries start up, like those dudes from Helicoastal are trying to get cooking.
Yeah, they're starting to put out
several...
They've got several beers out right now.
Yeah, they've been doing, like, a bunch of collabs. I had one of their beers over at Almanac. We were just doing a collab over there with
that
Phil.
That Kolsch?
Yeah, it was, like, a Kolsch with, like, orange or something
in it. I talked about that one recently. I was kind of afraid of it. But, like, I know the Almanac, Phil, and the guys at Helicoastal. I was like, I'm rooting for them. But I was a little afraid of that beer. But I actually really liked it.
Yeah, I thought it turned out great. I know they did some with, like, with Rare Barrel and RM over at Federation's been doing some collabs with them and stuff. So, like, it's rad to see, you know, people just into craft beer and trying to do stuff and get more folks into it.
Yeah. I know they did one at, with Temescal a few weeks ago, maybe a couple, probably more like a few months ago. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, just the collaborations that they've been doing and,
yeah.
And yeah, I think Oakland is a beer city that maybe people outside the Bay and the East Bay don't realize yet.
Yeah.
But it's, I think definitely Oakland is coming up on it's going to be on a lot of people's radars, I think, real soon for a beer.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. And maybe that, you know, is low key why I put another taproom in Oakland too, just to, you know, keep stirring it up, you know, having people experience craft beer, you know, and being in Oakland, I do think it's, like, really important. Like, you know, craft beer can kind of seem kind of bougie. It can seem, you know, kind of like a club or whatever. But, you know, it was important to us. Like, if you ever walk into a ghost town tap room, like, we have a $3 pint of beer, like, all the time. Most of our beers are $5. You know, even our bigger beers and stuff like that, they're $5. They're just a smaller pour or whatever. So we really think it's important that craft beer is accessible to everybody. And that, you know, come on down and drink some beers and, don't let the spooky metal dudes scare you. We're more of like a, I don't know, don't give a fuck kind of attitude. Like we, you know, we're who we are, but we're super chill. And, yeah, we're just passionate about a craft beer and knuckle dragging death metal. So that's kind of our bag, I guess.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and wrap it here. But thanks for taking the time on a Saturday and, you know, doing this, and there's probably other things you could be doing than on a Saturday midday.
I'm always here anyway, just working on stuff, spilling glycol over myself.
All right, there you go. Ryan from Ghost Town out of Oakland. They've really quickly become one of my favorites. Like I said, top-notch West Coast IPA, good range of lagers. I think they just released a Fooder-aged Schwartz beer, which is kind of cool. They do the hazy stuff. I have a can of a barley wine rye blend. Very much looking forward to giving that a try. In the meantime, I do have some Inhume, which is one of their West Coast IPAs, and it's fucking delicious. And if you're into the sour, funky stuff, Ghost Town's really getting into that. Ghost Town is, to me, it's definitely worth seeking out their beer. Like Ryan mentioned, they have two tap rooms. The new one I have not checked out yet, but hoping to soon. And you can check out Ghost Town on Instagram and online, probably Facebook too. But I'm not sure people still even use Facebook, because fuck Mark Zuckerberg. But anyway, you can go follow the Beer Truth Podcast on Facebook and Instagram. You can check out past shows and random blog stuff on the website, beertruth.com. Subscribe on your favorite platform for listening to podcasts. However you're listening right now, that's what I'm talking about. Or all podcast platforms. Go subscribe on all of them. And 5 stars on everything. Leave a review and a rating, and I will be eternally grateful for whatever that's worth. Which is probably not much, but anyway, thank you for listening to this one. Stay tuned for next week. We've got some big things coming. Next Tuesday, I have a pretty big interview I'm very excited about. Big things coming around the bend. So, yeah, till the next round, Slotja.